Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students program, and Steve Brown, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership at UW-Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. Today's program features Dr. Andrew Hacker, who is a professor of political science at Queens College in New York City. He earned a PhD from Princeton University, and he is the author of several books on various topics from race relations to gender differences to higher education. Dr. Hacker's new book is called The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions. So I invited him on the show today to discuss his book, his experiences as an instructor in higher education in both political science and math, and to respond to some of his critics. So, Dr. Hacker, welcome to Education Matters.
Well, Karen, it's really great to be with you.
Well, good. I'm very honored to get to do this interview. For our listeners, in case you want to try to picture this, Dr. Hacker just told me that he is speaking to us from the middle of Manhattan in a 40-story apartment building, but not on the 40th floor, right?
That's right.
Okay, so the first question I have for you, Dr. Hacker, is how does a political scientist come to write about math instruction?
Okay, a good question. As a political scientist, my main interest is in policy. I know that sounds a bit wonkish, but hey, we're interested in health policy, in military policy, in transportation, all sorts of things. And what we want to do is to provide the most rational, fair, equitable forms of governmental programs for people. That's what we political scientists do. Well, I found myself turning to education. And in particular, I began to discover that we are, as a matter of educational policy, requiring every single teenager in this country take a full sequence of mathematics. And I began to ask a very simple question, a three-letter question. Why? Why are we doing this?
And so that led you to just look into this policy and gather lots of information about it, and then how did it become a book?
Well, what I discovered was that requiring a full sequence of mathematics for everyone is doing a lot of damage. Most people don't know it, but the United States has one of the highest high school dropout rates in the advanced world. You know, we're well behind. We're about 21st out of 23 countries in the proportion of our teenagers who graduate from high school. We have one of the highest dropout rates for colleges. 45-47% of our people who start in college do not finish. Now, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. The chief academic reason why people don't finish high school and don't finish college is a required mathematics course, which there's no rational reason that they have to take.
So what is the course? I mean, so one of the things that it sounds to me like is that this is a change, because I certainly didn't have that requirement when I was in high school. So has math instruction changed over the past 30 years, and why should it change again to the form that you're recommending?
It certainly has. Back in 1983, as you pointed out to me when we talked earlier, the Reagan Education Department produced a report called A Nation at Risk. And they said, gee, our educational system's in a bad way. We have to make it more rigorous. And that was the word, rigorous. And, you know, when I think of rigor, I think of, gee, you know, something strenuous like push-ups, maybe push-ups with one finger. In other words, we're turning soft and we've got to kind of harden ourselves. And the best way, they discovered, to harden people is to make them take a full menu of mathematics all the way through high school and certainly in the first year of college. The notion was this will kind of harden Americans who have turned soft. And I began to ask, sure, I'm in favor of rigor. I've been a teacher for many years. But, you know, studying T.S. Eliot's poetry can be rigorous, too.
So you think they're misguided in this approach to too much or additional math, I guess? You think it's too much.
I think it's much too much, you know, and I'm not against algebra in the schools, or geometry, or even trigonometry. Of course they should be taught, but we should ask ourselves how much. For example, if we have students taking course in music, and by the way, we have less and less of this now because we have much more emphasis on so-called STEM preparation, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. But, you know, if we said everybody should really learn something about music, and then somebody said, yes, and also they should learn to play the cello expertly, everybody, we'd be saying, this is silly. What's the reason for it? You know, and I'm asking the same thing about all this mathematics. Why do we impose it on everyone? You know, Karen, we have, if you take 15-year-olds in this country, we've got 4 million of them. Why does every single 4 million of them have to take the sequence going up, people hope, through calculus?
I don't know. That does it. It's certainly not something that I think it's really interesting that I wasn't required to do that. And also, I just to be clear to the audience, I graduated from high school in 1983. So I went to a liberal arts college. I did not have to take math through calculus to get in. I didn't have to take math while I was there. But then eventually I did take the GRE and go to graduate school, and I passed two semesters of graduate level statistics at a competitive research university. So do you think, you know, one of the things that you try to put in your book is that statistics might be a more useful thing to learn for most Americans. And you don't necessarily need advanced algebra to be able to do statistics.
You've summed it up very nicely, Karen, that you don't need advanced algebra for the kinds of statistics that an educated, intelligent citizen would need. What we Americans are really fall short on, and again, here's another international survey, we're toward the bottom, behind countries like Slovenia and Slovakia, when it comes to what are called numerical skills. That is, an ability to deal with numbers, to read a corporate report, to look at a government budget, you know, and we're really behind on this. What happens is we teach arithmetic up through fifth and sixth grade, and then we start plunging people into algebra. And there's something interesting I discovered, that studying advanced academic math does not help you with quantitative and numerical skills. It doesn't. It teaches you about X and Y's, but not about the real numbers in a corporate report.
So do you happen to know if Slovenia and South Korea, do they actually teach this sequence of math that our students get, or are they learning something different, or just is it being taught differently?
Well, this is rather interesting. We know that the Chinese, the Koreans, do much better than we do. Their high school students do much better than we do on international math competitions. We know that. And there's a lot of worry about this because we're worried that these smart Asian countries are going to move ahead of us in the 21st century because our students are falling behind in math. Well, I'm afraid that's another myth. You know, the title of my book is The Math Myth. It probably has about 15 myths in it. If the reason why the Chinese and the Korean young people do so well is they work 23 hours a day. In fact, in Korea, there are already articles being written by pediatricians on one of the biggest health problems for young people in Korea is sleep deprivation. You know, 15-year-olds are getting 4 hours of sleep a night because they're working round the clock on math. Well, of course they do well. By the way, if the competitions were in crossword puzzles or chess, the Chinese and the Koreans would do well too because they'd put in those 23 hours a day. The question is, do we want to be like that? Do we want to set that up as our model?
That's a reasonable question. Now, there's another side of this that I heard. I actually posted your New York Times op-ed on a few different Facebook threads that I'm on to get some ideas. And one of the things that came up, and I know you've addressed it in your book, but I think it's worth our listeners hearing what you have to say. Some activists consider math education to be a civil rights issue One in particular is Robert Moses, who developed something called the Algebra Project to make sure that students of color, especially low-income students, have early mastery of algebra so that they can go on to greater academic success. So, you know, what is your response to him and to others who make that claim?
Okay. I've known Bob Moses for many years. In fact, Karen, I went down to Jackson, Mississippi, and sat in some of his Algebra Project classes at the Lanier High School. So I know exactly what Bob's been doing, and we discussed it over dinner afterwards. What he is saying is that if black kids, particularly from disadvantaged backgrounds, want to get into good colleges like Yale or Williams or... Where'd you go, Karen?
I went to a small liberal arts college called Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Of course we know Appleton, Wisconsin. I won't remember to mention the senator who came from there.
Yes.
But I certainly know Appleton. And you know what I call Appleton? It's one of about 150 colleges in the country, and I call them GISLACs. Are you ready?
Sure.
GISLACs. GISLAC stands for Good Small Liberal Arts College. Got to say it fast, though. GISLACs.
Right.
And GISLACs, like Lawrence, have been very good. Many of them now, for example, do not require the SAT.
Right, and Lawrence
they
doesn't.
You can come in without it, and the chief reason they say they don't want the SAT or you don't need it is because of the math section. And they realize that if they require high math scores, they're going to lose out on a lot of students who are interested in literature, modern dance, you know, that sort of thing. Now, let's get back to Bob Moses and the Algebra Project. What he's dealing with is rather desperate. He's got kids who really should get to college, or, gosh, they may end up with, you know, in a worse type of institution. So he says, do it. You know, I'm going to put it this way, Karen, and let's see what happens if someone wants to quote me. What Bob says, in effect, he doesn't use these words, is, look, guys, if we want to get ahead, we've got to do it the white man's way. And the white man says, jump through the algebra hoop, so we'll jump through that hoop. And that's what his project is based on. I want to get rid of the hoop.
Well, is that in any way cutting off the opportunity for some careers in what we call the STEM fields? I know this is the subtitle of your book is the and other STEM delusions. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you feel about STEM and the path that you propose, which is a little bit different than that.
Okay. A lot of myths about STEM, these STEM occupations. At most, only 5% of jobs, occupations, professions, only 5% require STEM type mathematics.
Let's define STEM for the audience. It's
okay.
Science,
S-E-E-M.
Technology, engineering, and math. It's an acronym for those fields. Right?
Absolutely.
So
right.
So only 5%?
5% of jobs require that. No more than 5. And if we say, hey, we should train more people in STEM skills, the answer is we don't have jobs for them. Currently, of people who have STEM college degrees, less than half are working in STEM fields. We don't create enough jobs. Microsoft obviously has STEM jobs. Guess what they did last year? They laid off 14,000 workers with STEM jobs, credentials. Why? Because the kind of products they were producing weren't being wanted anymore. So this is a real myth that we need more people with these jobs. What we do need people with, I would suggest, are creative-type jobs, much more akin to what you studied at Lawrence College. And because what's made America really great around the world is not so much our technology, but, oh, what shall I say, the kind of poetry that we bring to things that we sell.
The acronym that you proposed in the book is PATH, P-A-T-H. What does that stand for?
Well, you can use anything you want for PATH. I leave it up to the reader. It could be P-A-T-H, philosophy, art, theater, history. How's that? Now, why do I say this is important? Let's look at some of the things that we call STEM creations. Twitter, Apple, Google. Now, what's so interesting about them is not just what they do technically, but the terms themselves. There's a kind of artistry to that. The person who thought up Google, you know, that's what really sold it. The same with the term Twitter. And that's what comes from liberal arts. And what we're doing is we now have, because of all this emphasis on STEM, less liberal arts, both in our high schools and in our colleges. We're really shooting ourselves in the foot. Oh, just let me add one other thing. If you take video games, which are supposed to be high tech, I've talked to people in the video game business. They say over three quarters of our people are not tech people. They are people who do the artwork, the music, the characters, the voiceovers, the plots, the stories. That's what make video games work.
Right. I suppose if you were to look at the kind of work that they do in George Lucas's studios, there are a lot of techies there, but if it wasn't a good story, no one would go and watch any of those films.
Absolutely. And by the way, I am not anti-STEM or anti-mathematics. For example, in George Lucas's studio, when you take the animation there, there's a lot of calculus in it. So, for example, when you have lava bubbling up in, Tolkien-type, Hobbit-type story, or when you have somebody's cape snapping like a whip, it's calculus that puts together all of the equations that make for that animation. Of course it's needed, but it's only 5% of us.
One of my college friends teaches middle school math in a large urban district, and she says, I would like you to ask him if he considers his ideas to be about promoting thought or about promoting career skills. Does he see math as a subject important for its utility in everyday life or a job? Or does he see it as important to teach math as a way to interpret the world, or perhaps both?
I love your friend. Thank you. It is a way to interpret the world. It certainly is. For example, Galileo once said, the great book of nature is written in mathematics. Now, that's true. It's a marvelous statement. It's a marvelous truth. By the way, is that taught to you in algebra?
No, I don't remember that.
no way. In a class I've been teaching, we began to work on that. The great book of nature written in mathematics. And we look at the simple thing called pi. You know? Now, where did pi come from? Did we invent it, 314-159? No. We discovered pi. Well, how did pi get there? Well, it's part of the great book of nature. Does this sound a bit theological? Maybe it does. But nature says to us, I have all sorts of beautiful things you can find through mathematics. Isaac Newton called his book on calculus, you know, Principia Mathematica. The subtitle was, this was a study in natural philosophy. So I would love to have math taught, not as just doing a lot of trinomial equations, but as a liberal art. And I would love to have your friend, the teacher, teaching it to young people in the middle school that way. But she's forced, because of the curriculum, to have them slog through all those equations.
I have a feeling she might do a little bit of both because she did go to Lawrence, but we'll have to see. This is just a little reintroduction break. This is Education Matters on WGTD 91.1 FM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and I'm interviewing Dr. Andrew Hacker about his book, The Math Myth. If you are just joining us and would like to hear the earlier part of the interview, remember to access our webpage at WGTD.org, where this program will be archived early next week. You may also join us on the WGTD Education Matters Facebook page, where you can discuss this program with the hosts and fellow listeners. So we already sort of dealt with this a little bit, but I did want to ask you formally. We often hear about international comparisons between the U.S. and other countries, and that U.S. students are behind in math. Can you dissect those scores and this premise for our listeners? I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting about this concept that we're behind is my understanding is that the U.S. has never been on top of those lists. Is that correct? Or do you have other thoughts about these comparisons?
The comparisons are fairly recent. They're put out by the Office of Economic Cooperation over in Europe, and it's called PISA. I forget what it stands for, something international, scholastic, whatever. And some of these PISA scores were down there about 30th among advanced nations, which include, as I said, Slovenia and Slovakia. I think the real reason is that, and I don't want to sound like, let's say, some old-fashioned disciplinarian, but American students don't like to study hard. We do, teachers assign less homework, and we do less homework than in other countries. There's a much more relaxed atmosphere in American schools, and parents are more indulgent, even as they want their kids to get into fancy colleges. And I think it's much more a social and cultural matter. I think Americans could do as well as the Chinese if, you know, genetically they have the equipment to do it, but just not demanded of them.
Well, one of the other big differences that I know, and I want to make sure I put this out there for my math teacher friends, is that in the Asian countries, teachers don't spend as much time with students as they do in U.S. schools. I mean, our teachers teach 5 or 6 sections a day, and they're about the same size. Sometimes the Asian countries have bigger classes, but they spend a lot more time with the other teachers planning and dissecting the lessons to make sure that they're really teaching what they intend. And that's very different from what we do in the U.S., which is basically keep a teacher in the classroom all the time. They might get a 30 or 40 minute prep each day, but that's about it.
That is certainly the case. Let me give you an example on this, which comes down to, of course, math. There's a competition every year called the International Mathematical Olympiad. And high school students from 100 countries come to, last year they went to Thailand. That's teams of six from each country. That's almost 600 kids coming to Thailand. And they are the top math students in their country. The United States sends teams, of course, and so do 99 other countries. Well, I looked at the countries, the teams, which were in the top 10 of the International Math Olympiad, the top 10. And here's who they were. China, South Korea, okay. And then, are you ready? Iran, Russia, and North Korea. North Korea. Now, I began to wonder about that. The highest type mathematical skills can be generated in Russia, China, and North Korea. Now, you begin to ask, what kind of skill is mathematics if it doesn't need what we call intellectual freedom? Because in those countries, you've got to stick to math. You can't talk about other things. Apparently, mathematics is so isolated as a subject, it doesn't need the kind of freedom that you need if you're going to study history, literature, philosophy. And I don't have a real answer to this, but it tells us more about math, that North Korea example, than I ever thought it would.
So what do your math colleagues have to say about your ideas about math teaching?
Well, it is interesting. At my college, as you know, I'm a professor of political science. 3 years ago, I went to the math department at my college, and I said, look, I'm doing some work on your subject, mathematics. Do you mind if I teach one of the introductory math sections at Queen's College? So they said, sure. You know, we're kind of collegial there. And I said, I'm going to do it my way. It's not going to be algebra, geometry, or trig. It's going to be a course I'm calling Numeracy 101, in which we use numbers, as we said, to study a federal budget or to study how elections returns come out, or, for that matter, how we discover pi. And they said, sure, go ahead and do it. They were very relaxed about it. So in that sense, That was okay with them until, and I really don't want to get into this, they started getting some word from other mathematicians in other parts of the university who felt that somehow or other they had allowed an enemy into their camp. So they said, I think we're going to stop this after 3 years.
You don't teach that course anymore?
I teach it under another department called Special Studies or Interdisciplinary Studies. But my point is about my class that all you need is arithmetic. And one of the students said to me at the end of last semester, you know, Mr. Hacker, this course was more demanding, more rigorous than a calculus course I took in high school. Because dealing with numbers at a high sophisticated level, where you ask, what are these numbers saying? You know, let's take a look at this survey, this opinion poll. What was the sample? How were the questions worded? How much time did people have to answer them? That kind of thing is really very demanding, but all it requires is what I call adult arithmetic.
It is really interesting. I don't know if you have you heard of this gentleman named Edward Tufte, who does seminars for professors mostly on the visual representation of numerical data and how you can sort of create graphs and charts, et cetera, so that you can tell a story or not really do it very well.
I hate to appear to be showing off, Karen, but I know Ed Tufte.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yes.
Of course.
I won't say I know everybody, but I do know him. He does fantastic work.
Mm-hmm. I went to one of his seminars. It was really fascinating.
And it's worth buying his books mm-hmm. because he displays them there. And I remember he had one graph showing Napoleon's army going into Russia and how big it was when it started and how big it was when they finally, you know, surrendered and, fled. And one of the things I have, both in the book and in my course, is I say, okay, here are some numbers. I'm trying to do this now over the phone and over the radio. We're going to compare the number of telephones, percentage of homes having telephones, in two states, Arkansas and Connecticut. Well, that sounds, okay. This is just an exercise. Arkansas and Connecticut. Okay. In Connecticut, 98% of the homes have phones, and that includes cell phones. Arkansas, 94% have telephones. Now, how are you going to graph this? 98 and 94. Well, if you had two big sticks, 98, 94, from zero up to that, it would be just a small difference between the two states. Or what you could do is start the graph at 90, go through 90 through 100, and then you discover a big difference between Connecticut and Arkansas. Now, the both graphs are correct, but the question is, which do you want to use? Are you showing a bias if you use one rather than the other? What's your point? What's your purpose? How do you want the audience to react? We do that in my class, too, just as Ed Tufte does, but they don't do that in mathematics classes.
I was a history teacher, and I teach social studies teachers, so it is one of the things that I emphasize to them is that that is a skill they need to teach because, really, it's the place where students are going to get it. It's not going to happen in English, and it might happen in math at lower levels, but in high school, really learning how to read graphs like that is very important.
Absolutely. So, right. And by the way, my math colleagues, when I tell them what I do in my numeracy class, or at least some of them do this, they say, oh, that's dumbing down, not rigorous enough. What they're really saying is, and I have to be careful the way I say this, there are a lot of mathematicians for whom their subject is the one true church. They want everybody to worship in it. They want everyone to come every single Sunday without missing a beat. That's like the four full years of it. They want everyone to sit there whether they like it or not because it's the one truth. Well, I'm saying there are a lot of other ways to study the world. As you say, history, literature, philosophy, poetry, or just making up words like Twitter and Google. Google is a marvelous mathematical term, but most people who use Google don't know that.
So as I've explained, I shared this, your op-ed, with a bunch of different lists that I'm on. And one of the interesting ones is people in higher education, they're a little bit divided on this whole thing. So I heard from one colleague who teaches in a community college who says, yes, that Algebra 2 requirement is a really big barrier to our students. They can't even take statistics without it, and you don't really need it for statistics. Algebra 1 would be fine. And then I have another colleague, and then this has been my experience at the college where I currently teach, which is Carthage College, is that we don't actually require Algebra 2 proficiency. So this one of the colleagues said, I'd be interested in the statistics to back up his claim that we require this class. No institution I have been a part of requires Algebra 2. The Texas state system encourages a math for liberal arts type class that teaches problem solving and critical thinking. So how often is this a real requirement to get into college?
Okay, let's take for the moment two-year colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Two-year colleges require that you show a certain level of math proficiency before you can get into the two-year community college. You either have to have the certain grades and courses from high school, or you have to pass one of their, we know this word, remedial classes or developmental classes in math. And the dropout rates are fantastic. Why? Now, whether this is Algebra 1 or Algebra 2 is not the point. It's that it's a level of academic mathematics that is not needed for most people who go to liberal arts colleges, or, for that matter, community colleges. By the way, half of the degrees in community colleges throughout the country are in liberal arts subjects, you know. And even if you're going to do air conditioning and heating, renovation, that kind of program, or you're going to do a program in cosmetology, you can't start on this unless you've got over the math hurdle at the two-year college. The same thing is true at four-year colleges. Many of them have either a math requirement, grades, or SAT score, or ACT score, or you take the class. Again, it's the chief academic reason why we have such a high college dropout rate.
So I guess the question that my colleague asked was, is it really as widespread as you're saying? I guess it could be in community colleges. I'm less familiar with that. I did have someone chime in about community colleges requiring it. And I also have a friend who works for the CUNY system, and they are starting to revise that requirement. I don't know if you are aware of that. But how widespread is it elsewhere? I mean, maybe the private liberal arts colleges are kind of bypassing this whole thing because they can.
Okay, let's take some of the CUNY colleges. Mm-hmm. What they have is an option. It's called StatWay, mm-hmm, for statistics. You don't have to take academic algebra. You can take statistics. Well, I looked at those statistics courses. They started out as a pilot program at 19 colleges. And at the 19 colleges, it was a separate program in statistics instead of mathematics. And the instructors were given a lot of support and all the rest. Guess what? Half of the students didn't finish the course. They dropped out or they failed. In other words, the success rate was only 50%. Why? Because this was advanced academic statistics filled with algebra and all the arcane equations that professors of statistics want. I'm interested, Karen, in citizen statistics, where you hear a political speech and somebody, gives you numbers about employment. You should be able to ask questions. How are those statistics on employment derived? Where they come from? You don't need algebra for that.
We talked a little bit about this earlier. You say that really only about 5% of STEM careers are even STEM careers, and that even among those, they don't necessarily always need the same level of math. So there really doesn't appear to be a shortage in STEM-trained Americans. So why do you think we always hear that there is and that everyone should go into those fields?
Well, there's one economic reason, and that is that employers like to have a surplus of people so they can offer lower wages. This is true. And the more people you have, for example, who have who can do computer programming, software engineering, the more you have, and the fewer jobs there aren't that many jobs, you don't have to pay them as much. That's one reason why we bring in people on H-1B visas, because we pay them so much less than we pay Americans. I would simply say here that employers, you know, like to say there's a shortage because that helps them. Simple as that.
And then the second part of that point is, you said that even in a lot of STEM careers, you don't need advanced algebra. And I have an example, which I shared with you earlier. My husband, who has a PhD in biology, manages a pretty high-powered biology lab at the University of Chicago. He kind of oversees all the projects and makes sure that the grants terms are met and, you know, all the work gets done. And he's really great at math. He loves it, took all of the many courses in calculus and all the rest of it. But he says they never use those things at all in the life sciences. They really only just use statistics.
Your husband, Ted, your husband, he's absolutely right.
Yeah.
And it is true throughout the country. I have interviewed scientists, engineers, actuaries, and all of them say, yes, I had to do a tremendous amount of math to get into my job, but once in the job, I don't even use it anymore. I just use quantitative skills. This is true of engineers, even E.O. Wilson, you know, a very distinguished Harvard biologist, wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal saying even scientists at my level, except for a few in astrophysics, don't need math. Now, I do admit where it's needed. Of course it's needed. Among my trips, I went down to Marietta, Georgia, and I went to the Lockheed company where I spent a day with three aeronautical engineers. They use calculus all the time. Their current project was working on ice resistance on the wings of airplanes. And they said, you know, ice is different all over the world. In the Himalayas, it's different from the Andes, different from the Alps. And we have to have mathematical models which work out what kind of wing works best with all types of ice. So, of course, we need people like that. But we have plenty of them. They're being graduated all the time.
So there really isn't a shortage?
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which does very good projections, over the next 10 years, I didn't believe this till I read it twice, over the next 10 years from now, we will need fewer electrical engineers. Not more, but fewer electrical and electronic engineers. Why? Because those engineers have invented such sophisticated devices that they can now be run by technicians, and we don't need graduate engineers to run them anymore. In other words, they've invented themselves out of a job.
So the STEM careers that are growing, I think I read this in your book. I read a lot of things in preparation for this interview, so tell me if I'm wrong. That a lot of the STEM careers that exist actually really only need an associate's degree at this point because of what you were just talking about?
Absolutely. Like, for example, the people who run MRI equipment, you know, at hospitals. Sure, they know which buttons to press and all the rest, but it's amazing how sophisticated the machines have become. Do you remember that pilot who landed the plane in the Hudson River?
Mm-hmm. Sully?
You know, he landed it, and it floated, and everybody got out right.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, he said, I didn't save that plane and the people in it. The plane itself did. The plane was so built and set up that it knew how to land on water and so on. And this is really a brave new world we're coming to. And what we're doing, you know, there's a lot of worry about how technology will, you know, take jobs away from people. Well, it's also going to be true of STEM jobs.
As you know, I'm a teacher educator, and many of the students I work with are math majors who are intending to become math teachers. So what is your advice for them on this issue? What should be their position on math and how it's taught?
Well, at this point, our math teachers are protected. They're protected in the sense that at at the high school level, the Common Core is going to require up through Algebra 2, and as a result, everybody's going to have to take it. We don't have time to get on this now, but as you know, I have a chapter on the Common Core, and I think it's a total disaster. But at this point, there is a fair market for people to teach math because we require so much math. I would rather they would be able to teach also other alternatives and options, like the statistics, the numeracy we've been talking about, or the philosophy of math, the great book of nature. I'd love them to do all those things. So I want them to do their jobs and stay in the schools. I would just say I'd like to change the requirements that we push on all 4 million 15-year-olds.
So one of them just finished her third year as math teacher, and she wanted me to ask this. I fear that if it isn't a requirement, students will take the easy way out and not pursue these classes, and then not realize that, say, a career in engineering, which truly is calculus heavy, would not be something they could pursue. How do we keep the bar high and challenging for some while not discouraging others?
Okay, it's a fair question. First of all, apart from aeronautical engineering, which is a small specialty, engineering is not that calculus heavy at all. And much of engineering requires no more than, as I said, advanced arithmetic. Now, here's the question. Suppose there's somebody who, would make, a great actuary. You know, we need actuaries, to figure out what insurance rates are and what risk rates are. And it's a highly quantitative field. Now, we'd say, here's somebody who lives in, back road, trailer park, not very good surroundings. If we don't make them take mathematics, a full menu of mathematics, they'll never discover their skills as an actuary. Well, I only have to say, is that the only way we can help that young person, by making all 4 million 15-year-olds take math so the one person will find their skill as an actuary? Can't we find other ways to discover and develop talents of individuals without making everyone take it? Suppose I said in the years ahead, we're going to need millions of people who know how to speak and read Arabic. It's going to be much more an Arabic-speaking world. Are we going to make every single student learn Arabic because only 50,000 need that skill? We should be imaginative enough to find talent, encourage it, without having to use this blunt force of making everybody take the subject.
Okay. So we are just about out of time. What is the final thought that you would like our listeners to take from our discussion, besides to buy and read your book?
What I would simply say is, insofar as you're a parent or an adult citizen and so on, I know it's not the biggest issue around. There are so many more important issues. But we just might ask ourselves, can't we do something a little more imaginative with our education instead of just ritually and rigorously pushing so much mathematics on everyone? We're doing a lot of damage. My phrase is, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot with this. And there are other ways where we can find real talents that are out there, develop them, discover them, without making everybody learn trinomials.
This is Karen Sconzert in Education Matters here on WGTD 91.1 FM. I have been interviewing Dr. Andrew Hacker, who is a professor of political science at Queens College in New York City, about his book, The Math Myth and Other STEM Delusions.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring a new vendor, Roll With It. Try something new and different for breakfast or lunch. Egg rolls with great fillings like a bacon breakfast roll, chicken tikka marsala, or a cheesecake spring roll. Kenosha Harbor Market, 2nd Avenue and Plaza Del Rey, open Saturdays 9 till 2.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Society's Assets will be holding